Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go.
My guest, Steve Cuss, is the lead pastor of Discovery Christian Church in Broomfield, Colorado. He also teaches leadership development classes and conducts self-awareness seminars in the United States and internationally. He's the author of the book Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, and host of the podcast of the same name. Steve lives with his wife, Lisa, and their three children in Broomfield, Colorado. Steve, my friend, thanks for being on the show.
Shane, great to be with you.
So you and I have known each other for a little bit. We're both kind of associated with Missio Alliance. You've written some things for them in the past, and I believe they host your podcast as well. I think it was last year, 2020, that I finally read your book. I think I listened to the audio version of it, Managing Leadership Anxiety. What I liked about it, I liked a lot of things about it. But one of the things I liked about it was a lot of this was based on your experience in being a hospital chaplain.
Yeah.
I think I've told you this before, but my wife is a hospital chaplain, and the secondary information that I get from her about it, I realize that that is a job like no other.
Yeah. I wonder why we all seminaries don't require it, you know, regardless if you're going to be a youth minister, worship leader, whatever. It is a singular experience. And I think you learn more from chaplaincy because you're dealing with people in the worst moments of their life. You're actually witnessing death on an almost daily basis, and it changes you, and it forces you to consider your theology. I think the best thing it does for people like me, you know, I'm kind of a type A driven leader, is it stops us thinking we can have a solution, or it stops us from stupid pithy answers when people are in pain. So yeah, man, I can't say enough good about it.
So Kate did go to seminary. She has the seminary degree in her family, and she had took a few CPE classes, what they call them, the clinical pastoral, and it kind of always stuck in her head that she'd always liked it, you know, kind of put a bookmark in that. And then, you know, after graduating, did church work and stuff like that. And then when we moved to Austin after a few years, she thought, you know, I really think that might be for me, and started looking into it, and found out that here in Austin, generally to work at one of the hospitals, you need to go through a clinical pastoral residency.
Yeah.
And one of the hospitals here offered that, and we looked into it, and it was a year-long residency. You got a, you know, a stipend. And, you know, we were both kind of annoyed that her MDiv wasn't enough to jump into chaplaincy. And during that year of her residency, I think it quickly became evident to her and me through the things she was telling me that seminary in no way prepared people to be chaplains. And the training was so arduous and very much like your own. And I want you to tell some of these stories, but the training is literally on the job training. And I don't know if it was the same for you, but I think during the day they kind of had their small classes. I say classes, it was just kind of a group meeting and being taught. And then at night they were the chaplains for the hospital system. And so, you know, pretty much before you get to learn anything, you are tossed into the fire, so to speak.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm sure every hospital does it differently because it is quite dependent on the CPE supervisor. All I can say is in our hospital, when you say, you know, during the day you're in classes, I have to hold my chuckle because for us it was a 1.5 hour group therapy session where they refused to tell you what to do. And then the rest of that day and then all night, you're the chaplain. And so the whole model of CPE you know, people give seminary a bad rap. They say, you know, I wish they taught me this in seminary. There are just certain things you can't learn in a classroom.
Yeah.
And then there are certain things that you can't be prepared for or warned about. And so the chaplain experience somehow has come to grips with that. And they just very happily throw you in the deep end from day one. You know, my very first chaplain encounter, they simply refused to tell me what to do, to the point where I'm thinking, wait, am I supposed to call a coroner? Is that my job? Like, I didn't even know procedure.
Yeah.
And then I'd never seen a dead body. I remember the first time I was with a family and we had to go visit their mom. She had died on the surgery table unexpectedly. I remember thinking, what if I am in the room with them and their mom and I throw up or I faint because I've never seen a dead body. I don't know what I'm going to do. The chaplain supervisors are extremely comfortable making you as uncomfortable as possible. And it's all intentional to get you anxious so that you can then integrate your anxiety into your leadership. It's quite this diabolical tool. And the technical word for it is action, reflection, action. They don't believe in education and action. They make you go in there and act, and then you reflect on your action, and then you go act again. But you never get to learn. Like, they never sit down and say, here's what to do. All of your learning, I don't know if this is the case with your wife, but all your learning is reflective learning. So doing a family of origin study, it's all about the assumptions you hold. It's not about how to be quiet when someone's asking you why God could allow this to happen. So it definitely made me, I mean, it was instrumental in both my own faith and then the way I navigate being a pastor. And so I don't know if I'm evangelical or not. I never have quite fit into that, but I sure look like an evangelical pastor until you hear me talk and teach. And then I don't sound, I'm kind of a evangelical that sounds almost Anglican, I guess.
Well, I know that for my wife's experience, a lot of it was, yeah, that deeper stuff. I think we actually discovered the Enneagram for the first time when my wife's group went through that. And then also it was having these experiences, writing up a verbatim, or, you know, in other words, what happened, and then going back to the group and saying, okay, here's what you did wrong. Here's where it could have done better. And here's where you were saying that they said this and you responded in this way. And it seems as though you said that to make yourself more comfortable rather than comforting them.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Verbatims are interesting. I think I did over 60 of them. I was trying to remember, but it was typically one a week. And sometimes you'd have to do two a week, one with your supervisor and one with your group. And I don't know why more church staffs don't do this. I did a whole chapter on verbatims in my book. And, you know, since the book came out, I do all kinds of consulting and I'm working with teams a lot. I've never yet been asked about a verbatim. It's almost like the back of the book, which is the real deeper tools people just are afraid of. But I can't think of a more life-changing experience than having to do a set of verbatims with a group of people you trust. You learn so much about yourself, and it's really not about a do-over. It's really forcing you to notice the way you show up when you're anxious so that you have that insight and awareness to show up differently over time. It's really a powerful tool.
You know, I was thinking the Managing Leadership Anxiety, the book, it's like a real anomaly in the genre of leadership books.
Yes,
in the best way, because I've read my share of leadership books and they're, you know, they're fine, most of them, except the ones that aren't. But it's usually from the perspective of a CEO of a company, sometimes a pastor or something like that. And a lot of times those books deal with the real mechanics of leadership and, you know, how do I scale? How do I fire people? How do I hire people? Which are all fine. Like, those are good skills to know. But I feel as though, and I think we've seen this in the last couple of years, a lot of people who have had those skills down really well, or perhaps expert in those skills, have really failed as leaders because of, you know, maybe what we call like a moral failing or something like that. Or it's just that we have seen they have left a trail of bodies in their path of hurt people, of you know, emotionally abused people, because although they have learned to whatever, grow a company to a certain size, what have you, they've not dealt with some of the stuff inside of them that will absolutely come out under stress.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, my thesis is pretty simple. If you are going to be any kind of a leader worth following, which itself is an audacious assumption, the only possible option is to be a fully integrated leader. And that doesn't mean that you have your life together. It means that your private life is congruent with your public reputation. And some of these more famous people that have fallen, you know, it represents a whole lot of unfamous people that have fallen that just were not big enough to make the news.
Yeah.
It's an absolute epidemic in church leadership. And it's because that these people, I mean, I don't mean to be like, make it a generalized statement. I just know this is true. It's because that they have not addressed their own chronic anxiety. Like chronic anxiety, you know, anxiety itself is a big word. It covers a lot of territory. All I'm interested in is chronic anxiety. So PTSD, for example, or acute anxiety, these are all specific. Chronic anxiety is always based on a false need. And when you are living out of a false need or a false belief, and you don't get that, then all kinds of interesting things happen next. So like maybe you're a people pleaser, maybe you're a perfectionist. Obviously in the book, I get into much more specifics. But if you're not knowing and naming these false drives you have, then your chronic anxiety is going to eat you alive. And I think that's what happened with a lot of these people. Most of them just got really sophisticated at hiding a secret life. But they've been practicing it a long time. But they didn't get into ministry to do that. They had some areas of brokenness in their life that in chaplaincy, they really wring out of you. Because if you have brokenness and fears and assumptions and these cravings and needs, and then you spend every day dealing with death, it's going to force you to deal with it. So a lot of these famous people tragically just simply have not had a safe environment to deal with their chronic anxiety, and so they burn out.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that most of these people didn't get into whatever it was, whatever type of leadership it was, ministry or business, for bad reasons or seeking to hurt people. And oftentimes I feel like in these cultures, there is a level of permission given to not be the same person, if that makes sense. Like, yeah, we almost kind of expect some people in some situations to kind of have this other life that's not fully integrated.
Yeah, the more gifted you are up front on a stage, the more permission we give you to be an ass behind the scenes. And it ends up being pretty twisted. I think the tragedy is that the upfront leader, when they first started feeling that pressure, you know, something's growing or they're becoming famous, that's the moment where they're not integrating anxiety. And when everything falls around them, we end up blaming that leader. Now, I do think that leader carries massive responsibility and has done massive damage. I don't mean to understate it, but the whole system has agreed at some level to let him get away with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's what you usually find out, is people looking the other way, or maybe they had a hunch. But also that leader generally, my take is that upfront leadership generally creates narcissism. Mm-hmm. I've been a lead pastor now for 15 and a half years, and I can feel it. Like the fact that I get on a stage and I generally have a 30-minute monologue most weeks and everyone's looking at me, if I'm not careful, that is actually going to form my soul. And I'm going to start to believe what people tell me, which is God speaks through you in unique ways, all of this stuff. But the reason people are getting spiritual meaning out of my preaching isn't because I'm close to Jesus, and it isn't because my character is intact. It's because I've been trained. Like I just was really well educated in the Bible. But I think when we hear somebody on a stage give a spiritual connection, we ascribe to them spiritual power rather than just saying, oh, he or she is really well trained or really experienced public speaker. That person has a gift of public speaking, which is unrelated to their character and is unrelated to whatever holes in their life or chronic anxiety they're carrying.
Yeah, especially in the church, we could really elevate someone who is a really good public speaker. And the part of the problem with that is that that is a secular gift, if you will. like that is not a spiritual gift. And it's really problematic when we elevate people, when we fast track people for leadership, and we don't value that the inward life that you're talking about, the integrated life. I want to go back to some of your chaplaincy experience, because in the book you tell a great story at the beginning, and I know you've told this several times in several places, but there's so much good stuff there. Where it sounds like one of your first days of chaplaincy, and we should say you were like 24 when you became a chaplain. Is that right?
Yeah, I was 24. The first day of chaplaincy was the last day of my honeymoon, and the opening story in the book is my very first ever encounter as a chaplain. I'd been on the job less than 2 hours.
Yeah, I was, I think it was either 23 or 24 when we first started our church. We started our first church, and I was a pastor. And it frightens me to think of that 24-year-old me in the situations I was putting myself in. But you tell a situation where you're in a level one trauma hospital. This family has just learned that the matriarch of the family has died. And like it happens in a lot of hospitals, there's chaos with the family and somebody says, send the chaplain in, they'll fix everything. And you, with not much training, are kind of tossed into that situation. What happened?
Yeah, literally, the chaplain supervisor, like you mentioned, your wife does CPE. There were six of us our first day on the job, but one of us had to carry the on-call shift, so I went first. So I had a 28-hour overnight shift. So I had all these pagers, all these beepers on my body. And the supervisor, Randy, he's just touring us through the hospital, just literally orienting us around. Hey, this is the heart floor. This is the cancer floor. And as he's doing it, I am absolutely freaking out. Like, I'm an Aussie, and we Australians actually, we work hard to make you believe that we're laid back and relaxed. So on the surface, I'm looking fine, but underneath, I'm terrified, but I'm so young and out of touch with myself. I wouldn't have been able to tell you I was terrified. I wouldn't have thought it was okay to say I'm afraid. So probably an hour and a half into that, the beeper goes off and Randy summons me off to go take care of this family. Again, I've already covered it. Refusing, I asked him outright what to do. And he just looked at me very kindly and he said, well, we're all about to find out. And I thought he was like chunking me because I was far and away the youngest. But I looked at him again. I remember, I was like, well, like, what if I make a mistake? The stakes are so high. And he looked at me and he just said, you are going to make hundreds and hundreds of mistakes this year. And that was, to this day, that's the most chaplaincy advice I've been given by a chaplain. So yeah, sure enough. I don't know, maybe less than 5 minutes later, I'm in a room with about a dozen screaming people. I didn't know what happened. The doctors and nurses are in the room. They're trying to manage everybody. They leave. It's just me and this family. And that really was like the crucible when I realized, okay, this is the first 2 hours of a whole year. This is the first 2 hours of a 28-hour shift. Here we go. What's interesting, Shane, is there's a lot I could talk about that experience, but after attempting to be helpful, I just took over the room. There was a lady who was headbutting the wall. I tried to talk to her. She was in shock. So I just physically grabbed her by the shoulders and very gently walked her over to a chair. And then I just started kind of like being proactive. And what I teach people when I talk about this is I've always been a fan for being a proactive leader. It's one of my gifts. And we often don't realize that sometimes our action is anxiety. Like, for sure, me being proactive is a gift, but sometimes the evidence that I'm anxious is I'm being proactive. So one of the simplest questions anyone can ask themselves is, what do you do when you don't know what to do? Anytime you're in a situation where you don't know what to do, also known as the last 12 months for most leaders, what do you do? What happens next? And so I was proactive. Somewhere in there, the charge nurse came in. She ushers me out of the room. She's angry at me. I've never even met her before. We haven't even exchanged names. And she's angry at me because she needs to get the dead body out of the bed so she can turn the bed, clean the sheets for the next patient. And again, Shane, I wouldn't have been able to say at the time, but over that year and over the years, I've learned, okay, I'm a chronic people pleaser. So what happens with anxiety is I meet with this nurse. I don't know what to do. She's barking at me to get the usher the family in to visit their mom. Now, what anxiety does is it takes over and infects your ability to see what's needed. And instead of seeing what the situation actually calls for, you end up just reacting out of your own anxiety. So what the situation called for was about 2 or 3 hours of just sitting with this family and giving them time to move through their shock. But because I didn't know what to do and because the nurse was angry, I was full of anxiety. So I took charge and I hustled this poor family into the ICU at least 2 or 3 hours before they were ready. And so that's just an interesting, like it happened, but it's also an interesting metaphor for how often leaders act because we don't know how to manage anxiety. Oftentimes, Shane, a lot of leaders I work with, they didn't even know the signs that they are anxious. So yeah, that was that first encounter. I remember the whole encounter took about 3 hours, and I remember thinking, okay, well, 25 hours to go. Like it was almost a dark humor, you know, it was really something.
Well, you said a few things there that I really think are important. One of the things you said in the beginning was you didn't even know you were terrified. And yeah. I think that that is something I identify with so much, is just being in touch with my own feelings. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like that is something that was learned, meaning I feel like as a parent of young kids, they are very in touch with their feelings. And so at some point we kind of got the message that was a bad thing and we should detach. And not only do we not act on our feelings, we're not even aware that we're having them at the time. And so I wonder if you could just talk about how important that is as a leader to be in touch with those feelings, and then what do we do with them? Right. Cause we can, there's a ditch on the other side, right? Where we're very aware and we allow those feelings to control us.
Yeah. Yeah. And my experience is most leaders are the last to know when they're not okay. And we're just out of practice. So it's sometimes our wiring. I know for people who appreciate the Enneagram, sometimes you can learn more about it through Enneagram numbers. Oftentimes it's also because we simply don't understand what happens when we're in the grip of anxiety. We think anxiety is worry and fear. And for a lot of leaders, they just say, well, I'm just not naturally a warrior and I'm not afraid of much, therefore I'm not anxious. But anxiety can look like mansplaining, having to have the last word, being proactive, somebody telling you their pain and then you quoting them a scripture. Anxiety can look pretty sophisticated. Hmm. So it's really important to learn the signs when you're in anxiety's grip. Because, you know, I go into it in the book, but I believe theologically, when you're in the grip of anxiety, you're no longer attending to the work of God. You're only attending to yourself. So I think it's vital. And so a couple of early things people can do, I think the simplest thing you can do is you can ask a loved one, ask someone that loves you really well, whether it's a spouse or a team member, hey, how do you know I'm anxious when I don't know I'm anxious? And Shane will say, once your kids are about 8, you can ask your kids or your child. Mm. You know, I've asked my daughter when she's 14 now, but when she was 9, I would say, how do you know daddy's anxious? Oh yeah. And she knows, because like you said, kids are much more skilled at being in touch with their emotions. Therefore, they feel it when you're disconnected from yourself. So when I was on the code team, you know, rushing around the hospital, it just sucks, Shane, because you rush to the scene where someone's heart has stopped. And the doctors and nurses, they get to go in with a crash cart and the paddle, and they get to do something. But the chaplain, your job is to sit with the loved ones right outside the room. Like, you're not down the hallway in another room. You are right outside the door. You can hear everything going on. And your job is to sit as a calm presence, fully present to these people, but calm. That takes a lot of work. And the overwhelming need to say something is often an anxious response. You know, most leaders, we speak because we don't know how to be in a situation without managing it. So there's just a lot of tools that you can use to practice being present to yourself and being present to the situation and present to God before you act. So one of the doctors on the code team, I remember he pulled me aside. We'd had a particularly harrowing code. It had gone a long time. And he said, "Hey, Steve, just a little tip. Anytime somebody's heart stops, before you rush in, just first check that your heart is beating." And I was like, "What?" He's like, just take your pulse. And what he was saying was, you know, the same thing the flight attendants tell us. First put the oxygen mask on your own face. But I think most of us are so others-oriented. It's not always from a bad place. We just don't take seriously our own emotions. And some people, even in 2021, Shane, some leaders were trained to not allow themselves to have emotions. They were even told it was unspiritual. So I think there's a lot of work to be done there. And then therefore there's a lot of hope.
Yeah. I think so often we feel like when we enter into a situation, what we think is going to communicate to people that we care is matching their emotions. So, you know, if they're upset, being upset at the same level as them will show them that I have empathy for them. And what they really need and what would really show the most care and love is something that you said earlier, which is being a non-anxious presence at the time.
Yeah. So the general guideline is you want to be present to people to the level where you can tell that they feel seen. It's kind of complex, but basically you're looking for the signs that they feel seen and known. And so, you know, sometimes my concern with matching their level of emotion is it feels manipulative to me. Just that, as I heard that phrase, I was like, oh, that feels a bit contrived.
Yeah.
However, like my wife's a trauma therapist and she just became a therapist a few years ago, and we're both learning so much on her journey. She specializes in play therapy with children. And it just fascinates me, Shane, that sometimes because kids, particularly really young kids, when they're playing, they can't talk about their trauma. They can only play it out. And she's been trained on sometimes she has to actually model what they're feeling so that they can see their feelings in her. And then other times she has to react to how they're feeling so they can see the impact of their emotions on her. I was like, whoa, that's incredibly sophisticated. I think for your average leader, if somebody's hurting, you can enter all the way into their hurt, but just be mindful of your need to shrink their hurt down to a size you can control. That's what I see happen when pastors quote scripture, when pastors pray. It's because they've lost the capacity to be fully present for that person in their pain, and they need to shrink that person's pain down to a pithy scripture. Like, man, Philippians gets abused so much in the faith of people's pain. So I think that's the vision I'm casting, is just take your own pulse. Just be aware that that impulse to speak and act, it's not that it's bad. It's just check it before just giving into it.
The other thing that about that story is that you had your supervisor say, "Oh, Steve, this year you're going to make hundreds of mistakes." Yep. And I don't know how that hit you in the moment, but to me, I feel like that would be of a great comfort, because you're going in with the fear and the anxiety, I'm going to make a mistake. And he sort of gave you permission to be human in that moment.
Yes. Yeah. And then I think it took me a decade to really embrace that permission. But it is funny because now I actually prescribe mistakes to people and our staff when I see them getting it too safe. Mm. And, you know, 2020, fortunately, was great practice for us to make mistakes. There were so many decisions that leaders had to make that were uncharted territory. And I think when you have permission to make mistakes, the next step is just to tell the people you're leading. So pretty much every announcement we made as a congregation, when either I would get up or our executive pastor and I would get up, we'd say, hey, we may be wrong. We may change our mind. Things may be different next week, but for now, here's the best we're doing. And it really does diffuse the need to look like we have it together. I think that's critical. I think longevity for leaders is forgiving yourself when you make mistakes, because almost all our mistakes are public. And so we feel extra exposed. Mm. And then I think for faith leaders, we always think our mistakes are more serious than they really are because God's involved. And when God's involved, everything's like times a million. All this pressure. But all God wants from you is to be exactly human-sized. If God wanted someone smarter than you, then it's God's fault that you're there because God should have put that person in your place. You know. So yeah. I'm a big fan of Jeremiah in the Old Testament. He blamed God a lot. I think we should blame God for putting us in this position and then just do our best.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what advice you would give to people who are listening. How do we have hard conversations with people when someone has failed or underperformed, and how do we do that as a good leader? Because I think one temptation is to overdo it, to berate people, to belittle people. The other temptation is to just let it slide, to not say anything about it at all. And we can manipulate our words enough and our thoughts enough to be able to claim that either one of those is really love. And so if love is for the real world and not just kind of something we talk about in church or with our kids, how do we do that? How do we have those hard conversations in our real life in love as a good leader?
That's a really fantastic question. And I think it is for a lot of people who work with people, or you know, like you said, in families, that is the question. Hmm. So I'll address the question. I just need to set up, like, if you just picture that life is about four different spaces. So there's the space inside me. That's really the space we've been talking about most of this time. There's the space between me and God. There's the space between people, which is either between me and a person, or sometimes you walk into a room and you're noticing what's going on between people. Then there's this fourth space, which is the space inside you. And what I've noticed is we spend too much of our time trying to figure out the space inside another person, but it's the one space we can do nothing about. Out of all the three spaces, the four spaces, it's the only space you can't do anything about. I can't do anything about the space inside you, Shane. It's just that's between you and God and your own work. Actually, one of the signs that you're anxious is when you're spending so much time thinking, what are they thinking? Why do they do it that way? I can't believe they, that's the fourth space. So what happens is oftentimes people will call me and they'll pose kind of a question like you did. They'll actually give me a case.
Sure.
And they'll lay it out in the form of a dynamic. They don't really give me the content of what people said. They give me the process. They'll say, well, I do this and then she does that. And then I respond this way. And they'll call and say, we just do the same dance every time. And my number one advice is to work on your own anxiety, take your own pulse to where you can have that conversation with that person in a non-threatening way. You know, like you, Shane, you set up the dichotomy of like avoiding or being aggressively confronting. Mm-hmm. The third path is just to be very frank and very kind, but there's no heat in what you're saying, and there's no accusation.
Yeah.
And even if these people work for you, you're not coming above them. Like, I'm the boss and you need to.
Right.
It's something like this. It's something like, hey, I've noticed there's this dynamic between us, and I think I'm making it worse. So I want to share what I think the dynamic is, and I'm going to share what I think I'm doing that makes it worse. And then I'm hoping that you will tell me what you think I'm doing that makes it worse. If you do that, and if you can be a non-anxious presence, non-defensive, and they feel safe to tell you, you've now done three steps where you can then say, would you mind if I share what I see you doing that makes it worse?
Yeah.
But at this point, it's not, they're not the problem. The problem is the dynamic between you. And you're not coming in to say you need to fix it. You're saying you're recruiting them on your side. It's actually a move of intimacy. I would say that's the number one advice I give, and that's the number one move I make. Anytime I have a problem with someone, I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing that's making the problem worse. And then when I'm so-called confronting them, I'm confessing to them. That's how I'm starting. And I don't, it's not manipulative. Like if you hear people talk about the Oreo sandwich, you know, say two nice things and one bad thing in the middle.
Right.
Forget that. Just tell them the truth. So it's not about manipulating them or buttering them up. It's just saying, listen, I know I'm making the situation worse. Would you tell me how I'm doing that? And then you have the freedom to say, I think you're making the situation worse. Could I tell you how I think you're doing it? And then, you know, then I think you're off to the races.
And I think what I like about that is that it really forces you to at least be open to the idea that you have culpability in that dynamic.
Yeah. If you think that they're the whole problem, you're not ready to talk to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's never like, I don't know if we've mentioned overtly, Shane, but I was trained in family systems theory, and the guy that ran the chaplain was a student of Murray Bowen, who founded systems theory, and he was a dear friend of Ed Friedman. So I got a heavy dose of systems theory and chaplaincy, and then I chased it in grad school. This is what we're talking about. Systems theory suggests that the problem is never always inside somebody. It's also equally between people. So if you can stop worrying about the fourth space, what's going on in them, and really focus on what's going on between us, that opens up an opportunity, a possibility of, well, then what am I? There's something I'm doing. So like, even if somebody is like under-functioning, they're late to meetings, they're not responsible. In my case, it's always my over-functioning that's covering for them. Mm. That's part of the problem, because they're not feeling the weight of responsibility. Mm. So they under-function, I'm a classic over-function, and now we're in a pattern. So if I were to go to them and say, look, you're always dropping a ball, that's like blaming. But if I would say, here's the problem, I let you drop the ball and then I cover for you, that's part of the problem. That's a different dynamic. And then they might say, yeah, look, honestly, man, I just know that no matter how well I do it, you think you can do it better, so I just let you do it. Mm. Well, now you've actually gotten to the heart of it. And then you can start talking about the impact on each other. Look, when you drop a ball, I'm now stuck in the meeting trying to figure out how to cover for you. I don't want to do that. Can you, what should I do next time you drop a ball? You know, and then they're taking responsibility. So it's not on a podcast and audio, but this is the stuff I usually am coaching leaders on.
Does the process get tweaked at all if you're dealing with someone who's a volunteer? Because that's so much more sensitive. And I think something that pastors deal with all the time, where it's not someone who's an employee and they're not taking a paycheck. And so, but yet there are people who have assume some responsibility. They have, they've given some kind of implicit promise to do something, and then it's really dicey when that person underdelivers.
Yeah, I would say it makes no difference if they're a volunteer. It might add a dynamic, because these are people giving time and not. There's no money exchange. But the last case I consulted on was with a volunteer. And again, it takes a while, Shane, to get your thinking off the person and onto the system of people. Mm-hmm. So in this case, it was a volunteer in a AV department of a bigger church where they did live streaming. And they launched live streaming through COVID, and they reallocated this volunteer, I think before he was on the soundboard. I'm actually not sure, but he was in a different role that he was very comfortable in. And they made him run the camera where he wasn't comfortable. And he kept, in various ways, sabotaging it and not doing a good job.
Oh, wow.
And then the worship leader could tell that the lead pastor was angry. So the worship leader starts shape-shifting himself to cover for the volunteer, placate the team, and make sure everything's fine so when the lead pastor walks in, he doesn't blow his fuse. So what you do is you're trying to actually, it's almost like a chess game. You're trying to get all the pieces on the board and every move everyone's made. And now you see an established pattern. So what the case was is this volunteer had simply been put into a role he was uncomfortable with. He's the kind of person who wants to be helpful to the church. So when they asked him to do it, he said yes. Then he finds himself over his head and he feels like he's failing. He can sense he's in trouble with the AV guy and he doesn't know how to say he's no good at this because it feels incompetent. So to the great credit, this leader, the worship leader, went in and just named all that to the volunteer. And I think what's happened is you, because you're a kind human, you said yes to something you actually never wanted to do. And the guy's like, yes. And then you realize you couldn't do it and you didn't know how to get out of it. And the guy basically broke down crying. He's like, look, I feel like I'm letting everyone down. I can even see the pastor doesn't like me anymore.
Yeah.
This is the power of systems theory. It's never about blaming. In fact, systems theory actually teaches you to look for the identified patient, the one that everyone says is the problem, the scapegoat, so that no one has to look at their own complicity in the situation. But human relationships are way more complex than that. So if you can look at all of the players, what everyone is doing to make the problem worse, then a calm leader can step in, name the dynamic. And the beauty is you can dissolve problems that have been going on for months or years in hours and weeks. It's literally miraculous.
And then on the other side of that, how do we receive criticism well when we're on the other side of that conversation? And it seems to me that those conversations can really reveal anxiety in us, that can come to the surface, and those things that we have picked up from maybe our family of origin or other, you know, past experiences can really bubble to the surface when we're approached with our fallibility by other people.
Yeah. You know, in the early days, I think there's no getting around that you're going to be defensive and hurt. I think it's as simple as, if we really do believe the truth sets us free, then we want the truth. And so, you know, I think I still get defensive when someone has a criticism of me, and I'm a pretty thin-skinned guy. I feel deeply and I take things personally. But underneath that initial reaction, I want to do the best I can. And I don't want to have a negative impact on people. You know, I'll never lead in a way where my shadow side does not negatively impact people. But I can still have the courage to go to my team and say, how do you experience me? Like, what is one aspect of the way I lead or operate that you would like me to work on because of the impact it has on you? And those are painful conversations, and then they're really, really liberating. Because I think chronic anxiety acts a lot like sin. You know, I don't particularly think chronic anxiety is sin. I just think it acts a lot like sin. When we're in the grip of it, we want to hide and blame. But I really do think the gospel of Jesus has so much to say about the truth and bringing that darker side of us out into the light. And you'd just be amazed at the ability to create a healthy team culture when you're that kind of leader. Mm. And so what I would do is, if I'm, like in my case, I'm the lead pastor, I make it in our organization that anybody can come and tell me how they've experienced me. Like an intern can come, for example. Mm. I say to them, thank you. Even if I'm combative in the moment, I'm saying, thank you for coming to me. I know that took a lot for you to say that. And then what I usually say to people is, this is a lifelong habit of mine, like this thing you pointed out. So it's going to take a while for me to get the hang of it. If you see me do it again, I'd appreciate you telling me.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of two key leaders that we've worked together for years. Sometimes they've had to tell me two or three times when I've done this thing because I didn't even know I was doing it. And then I can slowly start to notice it and work on it.
I think that's so valuable because I think a lot of leaders' reflex would be to say, if they weren't defensive about it, if they weren't denying it, their reflex may be to say, thank you, that'll never happen again, which is not realistic, and it's not really a trajectory for growth then.
I think it is an unrealistic expectation. There's also other leaders that'll say, you know, you don't know what it's like to be me. If only you knew the pressure I carried and how hard it is. They get quite combative that way. And I think that is a really sophisticated form of entitlement. I think that is what we've seen from some of these more public, unfortunate, tragic failures, is this kind of exceptionalism that the leader believes and that everyone around them believes. So I think this other path it relieves me from the pressure of being more than I really am. I don't know that many of my team are particularly impressed with me, because they see me at my best and worst. I hope that they're just grateful that I'm open about it, you know, and that gives them freedom to be open about their dark side as well. So I think some probably would say, oh, well, I'll never do it again. I think it's better to say, hey, a couple of years ago, one of my key leaders said to me, he said, look, when you're in a staff meeting, or like you're up front in front of us and you're teaching us a concept, like that was the time where I was really teaching some of these concepts we're talking about now. He says, you're teaching us one of these concepts and we don't understand. He said, I see it in the staff. They'll ask two or three questions and they're still not getting it. He said, and you double down. Like, it's like you step on our necks. It's like you've run out of patience with not understanding. He said, it's not good. You kind of almost, you don't threaten us, but it's like it gets aggressive. Hmm. And I think my initial response to him was aggressive. I think I was like, well, I have to understand, or something. But then later I came back and said, hey, I don't think I heard you well, but I want you to know I heard you now. I was not aware that I did that. I've had no awareness at all. And I've been doing it, you know, my whole adult life. So I'm going to need you to show me when I do it again. So he had to show me three times. And then I remember the fourth time I did it, I caught it in the moment. I was able to say, ah. And I was able to tell people, hey, I've got a friend who's been showing me this part of my life. This is the first time I felt it in the moment. I just want to name it to you guys. And I'm really sorry. And I'm working on it. Most people will give you all the patience you need to change if that's the kind of leader you are.
Steve, I know you've got your podcast, which has been really excellent, kind of provides an ongoing, conversation that people can have after reading the book. Talk to me about like what kind of things have you gleaned from that and how they've been helpful?
Man, the podcast has been so much fun. Mostly I do it to learn from my guests. I originally did it because I was a complete unknown when I published, and you know, HarperCollins told me, they're like, hey, you need to build some kind of platform. So I originally did it believing it would build a platform audience for my book. What it's really done is connect me to some incredible thinkers. And then I've recently launched this 1st of January. I launched an online community called Capable Life. It's at www.capablelife.me. Because the book came out and people listened to the podcast, but both of those mediums actually violate the way I think we change. I don't think you can change by listening to something or by reading something. You have to embody it. You have to put it into practice yourself. So you have to have a place where you can talk about it and then try it. And that really is the heart of the chaplain experience, that action, reflection, action. Go do it, reflect on it, try again. So since the book came out, I've been pretty busy consulting with teams, and I'll do workshops for organizations, but they're always like a one-off thing for a few hours. Hmm. So Capable Life, the first three letters is CAP, and that just stands for calm, aware, and present. So Capable Life is all about help giving you the tools to be a calm, aware presence in the workplace and home place. And it's this amazing online community. I mean, as of this recording, it's been open like 9 days. We've got already over 100 people from 7 different countries on it. And I've got a confidential discussion forum on there. I've got these little 10-minute videos where you can try something each week. We do monthly Zooms with coaches. It's intended to be a slow, steady experience for any leader or any parent that really wants to get deeper into these kinds of tools. Because, I love podcasting. I love being a host. I love being on shows like yours, Shane. It's really fun. I just know that people aren't going to change just listening to this. They have to be in some kind of a community where they can try it on.
Yeah. Well, Steve, thanks so much for a book that really sticks out in the genre of leadership books. And also, I wanted to state this earlier, but a lot of the kind of Venn diagram of leadership gurus and Christians, there's like a lot of overlap there, you know? But often it is, what it is it's like we took these secular leadership principles and we're Christians doing them, which is fine in and of itself.
Right.
But I'm always curious about the question of like, what difference does Jesus make in this? And I feel like your book gets to the heart of that better than any other kind of leadership book that I've ever read.
I really appreciate that. That's wonderful to hear. That my goal in the book and now, honestly, Shane, my number one goal in 2021 is to help leaders experience what they proclaim to others. Like the love of God, the peace of Christ, the freedom we can have in Christ. My goal this year is to help leaders experience that as much as they tell other people about it. Because I think we are some of the last to experience the love of God we so profoundly tell other people about.
Well, Steve, thanks for being on the show, and I hope you come back in the future. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SEMINARYDROPOUT, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah.